One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Dan Novak brings us the Health and Lifestyle Report about the international effort to prepare for future pandemics. Be sure to listen for Katie's chat with Dan after his report. We close with our American history program, The Making of a Nation. Steve Ember continues the story of the 36th president, Lyndon Johnson. But now, back to Katie and a report about herb gardening.
Herbs are among the easiest plants you can grow. They only need sunlight, water, and well-draining soil with a neutral pH. You do not even need a garden. Many herbs, such as rosemary, basil, cilantro, lemon balm, oregano, and mint, will grow well in containers. In fact, mints should only be grown in containers, unless you do not mind a garden takeover. Mint spreads extremely well. To get started, test your soil. Buy a pH test online or at your local garden center and follow the directions. A reading of 7 is best, but anything between 6 and 7.5 is generally acceptable for growing herbs. If the soil tests lower, add garden lime to raise it. If it is too high, add elemental sulfur to lower it. Follow directions on the product about how and how much to use. If growing herbs in containers, use a potting mix meant for edibles. The package label should include information about its pH level. Choose a site that receives at least 6 hours of direct sunlight daily. If your garden has sandy or heavy clay soil, use a moderate amount of compost, 15 to 20 centimeters deep, to stabilize drainage. If the soil is always wet, remove the top 15 to 38 centimeters of soil, then add 7.5 centimeters of crushed stone to the bottom of the hole. Combine some compost with the soil you removed and refill the hole with the mix. Create a mound at the top. It will settle lower over time. If you are using seedlings, follow the directions on the plant tags or seed packet. Some herbs are well suited for direct sowing into the garden. Check seed packets for guidance on spacing your herbs. Herbs will not grow well in wet conditions, so let the soil dry out a little between waterings. Herbs also taste better when grown without fertilizer. For this reason, do not overdo the compost when amending the soil to improve drainage. Chervil, summer savory, fennel, and lovage are exceptions. They do well with fertilizer. annual herbs complete their lives from seed to senescence or death in a single growing season. They include basil, cilantro, dill, chamomile, and marjoram. Perennial herbs, which return for several growing seasons, include rosemary, thyme, sage, tarragon, and oregano. Biennials, like caraway and parsley, live for two growing seasons, producing only leaves during their first year, then flowers and seeds in their second, before dying. However, if they are not strong enough to survive your winters, you may have to treat some listed perennials as annuals. For the strongest smell, harvest herbs in the morning, after the dew has dried, but before the sun gets intense. Use basil in meals with tomatoes. Add rosemary to chicken, pig, and lamb meat. Make tea with the very small flowers of chamomile. Use dill with Greek food, fish meals, and cucumbers. Sage and thyme are also great for many kinds of meat, and parsley will freshen your breath when you chew it. There are some interesting kinds of herbs to seek out, too. Pineapple sage carries the smell of the fruit it's named for, as do cinnamon and lemon basils, and strawberry and apple mints. There is even a chocolate mint, which is lovely when added to drinks like milkshakes.
Officials at the World Health Organization, or WHO, are negotiating new rules for dealing with pandemics. The UN Health Agency's 194 member countries have set a target date of May 2024 for a legal agreement. A new agreement is a top goal for WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. He called it a generational commitment that we will not go back to the old cycle of panic at the UN agency's yearly meeting. The agreement seeks to improve the world's defenses against new viruses. The effort follows the worldwide spread of COVID-19, which is blamed for killing nearly 7 million people. The WHO already has rules known as the International Health Regulations, passed in 2005. The rules explain countries' responsibilities when diseases and other public health events threaten to cross borders. WHO members approved the rules after the SARS outbreak in 2002 to 2003. These rules are still considered good enough for local epidemics, like Ebola, but not for a pandemic. The rules are also being reconsidered after COVID-19. Member nations have agreed that the new agreement should have legal force like a treaty does. It would be only the second such health agreement after the 2003 Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. That treaty aims to reduce smoking through taxation and rules on labeling and advertising. However, critics have voiced their opposition to the proposed treaty on social media. Opponents say approval could lead countries to give too much power to the WHO. The WHO says governments are leading the negotiations and are free to reject the agreement. The European Union proposed the agreement. The EU is considered its biggest supporter. Developing countries, especially in Africa, hope to use the negotiations to secure vaccines. After 5 rounds of negotiations, the latest version of the treaty still includes thousands of areas of disagreement or undecided wording. There is even disagreement over the definition of the word pandemic. With so many member countries involved, getting agreement is likely to be difficult. It is not yet clear how the 2005 rules and the new pandemic agreement might work together. Some think that existing rules should continue to apply to local outbreaks, with the new rules applying if the WHO declares a pandemic. But the WHO does not have the power to declare a pandemic. It is also not yet clear what happens if required measures are not followed. Separate talks on changing the 2005 rules are also taking place. Countries are proposing about 300 amendments to the rules. The first proposals from the United States aimed to increase transparency and permit the WHO to go more quickly to places where disease outbreaks are taking place. After a delay of about 1 year, China did permit WHO-led expert teams to visit the suspected COVID-19 starting point in Wuhan. But the WHO says China is still refusing to release information from early cases that may hold information about the beginnings of COVID-19. I'm Dan Novak.
We just heard this week's Health and Lifestyle Report from Dan Novak. Dan joins me now to talk more about the story. Thanks for being here, Dan. There was one word you mentioned in the story I was hoping you could explain further. Transparency.
Yeah, transparency is a very good word, especially when we talk about groups like the World Health Organization or other government institutions. Transparent objects are things that you can see through. For example, a glass cup is transparent, so is water. In the story, I mentioned that the U.S. wants more transparency from the WHO in the new agreement about pandemics. So, more transparency would mean more openness about how the organization makes decisions. You often see the word in relation to government. A government or a group that is not transparent is one that is secretive and hard to understand.
So, WHO member countries are hoping to come up with an agreement about how to deal with future pandemics. It doesn't seem to be going very well.
Well, there's certainly a lot of work to be done. The WHO has 194 member countries. It's been very difficult for everybody to agree to changes to WHO policy. In the latest version of the agreement, there were thousands of places where members disagreed. And there was even disagreement over the word pandemic.
Let's hope they can find an agreement before the May 2024 deadline. Thanks for answering my questions, Dan.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue the story of America's 36th president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Johnson was vice president to John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was murdered in Dallas in November of 1963. Johnson served the last 14 months of the president's term. Then he won a full term of his own starting in January 1965. Most of Johnson's time and energy would be taken up by the war in Vietnam. By early 1964, America had about 17,000 troops in Vietnam. The troops were there to advise and train the South Vietnamese military. Vietnam had gained its independence from France in 1954. The country was divided into North and South. The North had a communist government led by Ho Chi Minh. The South had an anti-communist government led by Ngo Dinh Diem. In 1957, communist rebels, the Viet Cong, launched a violent campaign in the South. They were supported by the government of North Vietnam and later by North Vietnamese troops. Their goal was to overthrow the government in the South. President Johnson believed that the United States had to support South Vietnam. Many Americans agreed. They believed that without American help, South Vietnam would become communist. There were concerns about the so-called domino theory, that if South Vietnam fell, other Southeast Asian countries would also fall to communists. As Johnson began his full term, his military advisors told him the communists were losing the war. They told him that North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong forces would soon stop fighting. On February 6, 1965, however, the Viet Cong attacked American camps at Pleiku and Quinon. The Johnson administration immediately ordered airstrikes against military targets in the North. Some observers in the United States questioned the administration's policy. James Reston of the New York Times, for example, said President Johnson was carrying out an undeclared war in Vietnam. In March 1965, the first American combat troops arrived in South Vietnam. Congress supported the president's actions at that time. However, the number of Americans who opposed the war began to grow. These people said it was a civil war. They said the United States had no right or reason to intervene. For 6 days in May, the United States halted bombing of North Vietnam. The administration hoped this would help get the North Vietnamese government to begin negotiations. The North refused, and the United States began to build up its forces in the South. By July, 125,000 Americans were fighting in Vietnam. Some Americans became angry. anti-war demonstrations took place in San Francisco and Chicago. More and more students began to protest. They wanted the war to end quickly. Some people thought the anti-war demonstrations were only delaying peace in Vietnam. James Reston believed the demonstrations would make Ho Chi Minh think America did not support its troops. And that, he said, would only make him continue the war. In December of 1965, the United States again halted its air campaign against North Vietnam. Again, it invited the North Vietnamese government to negotiate an end to the fighting. And again, the North refused. Ho Chi Minh's conditions for peace were firm. He demanded an end to the bombing and a complete American withdrawal. Withdrawal would mean defeat for the South. It would mean that all of Vietnam would become communist. President Johnson would not accept these terms, so he offered his own proposals. The most important was an immediate ceasefire. Neither side would compromise, however, and the fighting went on. In 1966, President Johnson renewed the bombing in North Vietnam. He also increased the number of American troops in South Vietnam. ...1966 was also a year for congressional elections. The opposition Republican Party generally supported the war efforts of Lyndon Johnson, who was a Democrat. But it criticized him and other Democrats for economic problems connected to the war. The war cost $2 billion every month. The price of many goods in the United States began to rise. The value of the dollar began to drop. Americans faced inflation and then a recession. To answer the criticism, administration officials said progress was being made in Vietnam, but some Americans began to suspect that the government was not telling the truth about the war. Opposition to the war led to bigger and bigger demonstrations. In July 1967, just over half the people questioned for opinion surveys said they did not approve of the president's policies. But most Americans believed that Johnson would run again for president the next year. Johnson strongly defended the use of American troops in Vietnam. In a speech to a group of lawmakers, he said, "Since World War II, this nation has met and has mastered many challenges. Challenges in Greece and Turkey, in Berlin, in Korea, in Cuba. We met them because brave men were willing to risk their lives for their nation's security. And braver men have never lived than those who carry our colors in Vietnam at this very hour." The price of these efforts, of course, has been heavy. But the price of not having made them at all, not having seen them through, in my judgment, would have been vastly greater. Then came Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, in January 1968. The communists launched a major military campaign. They attacked 31 of the 44 provinces of South Vietnam. They also struck at the American embassy in the capital, Saigon.
Military police got back into the compound of the $2.5 million embassy complex at dawn. Before that, a platoon of Viet Cong were in control. The communist raiders never got into the main chancery building. A handful of Marines had it locked and kept them out. But the raiders were everywhere else.
CBS News reporter George Sievertson described more of the fighting in Saigon and how it affected civilians in a poor part of the city.
This neighborhood is called the chessboard because of the maze of alleys and passageways. Its residents are mostly poor working people, and its slums are a refuge for Saigon's hoodlum and criminal elements. Vietnamese Rangers and Marines move carefully, blasting buildings and possible Viet Cong hiding places before moving ahead. This was the first time heavy fighting has taken place in Saigon proper. Until now, most of it has been in the Chinese section of Cholon and in the suburbs. The VC were difficult to dislodge. They obviously knew the section well and had built barricades in key spots. The Rangers and Marines took casualties, mostly from hidden snipers. As soon as the section had been cleared, more terror-stricken civilians scurried out of their homes, thousands of them fleeing from the bullets and explosives, and even more dangerous, a fire that began to rage out of control. Residents in nearby buildings began dragging their most precious possessions out of their shops and homes. Saigon's water supply system is operating only at 70% of normal, so fires are a serious menace. For these people, many of them who fled the war from outlying villages, this is the cruelest blow. The curfew has kept them from making a living. Food prices have tripled since the fighting began a week ago. And now, their homes are being destroyed.
Thousands of people were killed in the Tet Offensive. The communists suffered heavier losses than the South Vietnamese or the Americans. But many Americans were surprised that the communists could launch such a major attack against South Vietnam. For several years, they had been told that communist forces were small and losing badly. General William Westmoreland, commander of U.S. military operations in Vietnam, spoke with reporter George Sievertson.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
The enemy, very deceitfully, has taken advantage of the Tet Truce in order to create maximum consternation within South Vietnam, particularly in the populated areas. Now, yesterday, the enemy exposed himself by virtue of this strategy, and he suffered great casualties.
As a result of the offensive, popular support for the administration fell even more. Democrats who opposed President Johnson seized this chance. Several ran against him for the party's nomination in 1968. These included Senator Robert Kennedy of New York and Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. Kennedy and McCarthy did well in the early primary elections. Johnson did poorly. At the end of March 1968, the president spoke to the American people. He discussed his proposal to end American bombing of North Vietnam. He talked about his appointment of a special ambassador to start peace negotiations. And he announced his decision about his own future.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office. The presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Another major issue facing America in the 1960s was the civil rights movement, which sought to ensure equal rights for black Americans.
That's all the time we have for today's program. But we'll be back tomorrow with another Learning English program on The Voice of America. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.